Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The U.S. Senate was all set to turn its political guns on itself today in a long-awaited confrontation over judicial nominees. And it was to have been the battle over the filibuster, a fight for the very rules of the Senate. But the long-anticipated tactical war ended early last night with a compromise worked out by moderate senators, among them John Warner and Robert Byrd.
The one unanswered question that guided me all the way through is what would happen to the Senate if the nuclear option were done.
And I say, thank God for this moment and for these colleagues of mine. Thank you very much. Thank you.
At the center of all this are the people President Bush wants approved as federal judges. The Democrats think some of them are too conservative, and they had been threatening to use the filibuster to prevent the appointments from going through. Now, Republicans were just as determined to prevent the use of the filibuster, and they stood ready to change the Senate rules. But something, call it reason, call it caution, brought both sides to this compromise. Republicans will get most, if not all, their judges approved, and Democrats retain the use of the filibuster to fight another day. Now, this push for a compromise may well have been rooted in something else. Public opinion polls saying many Americans just really didn't care that much. So what do you think? Has Washington lost touch with the issues that matter to people? Are you fed up with all this partisanship? And looking at the events of last night, what exactly does this compromise mean to you? Is it a sign of common sense in the Senate? This morning we're going to be hearing from Washington and party insiders, and we'd also like to hear from you. We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today with Ron Elving. Ron is NPR Senior Washington Editor, and he's joining us from our studios in Washington. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So much huffing and puffing leading up to the events last night. Were you surprised that it ended in a compromise?
I must say I was. I did not see the language coming. I did not see the group of people coming together around a particular promise. And frankly, I think what we have here is largely a postponement and its agreement to have the fight a later day and probably not that far off in the future. I believe it will probably all come back to us when we get to a Supreme Court vacancy, which could be in a matter of weeks.
And we heard just a couple of moments ago from John Warner and Robert Byrd that sense of relief from two veteran senators that they didn't exactly step off the edge of this precipice. Their principal concern, of course, is the rules of the Senate and how their own matter of doing the nation's business might change. How much, though, Ron, how much do you think that they were watching the way this whole thing was playing out on the public side?
I think they were watching the polls. They always watch the polls. I think the polls put a little bit of stiffness in the spine of the Democrats because it appeared to be about a high 50s, roughly 60% defense of the Democrats' position we were getting from the polls. Now, of course, at the same time, if you ask people if a judge should get an up or down vote, you got a positive response to that suggestion as well. So the polls were going a little in both directions, but I do think they primarily acted to give the Democrats a little more courage in standing together against some of these nominees and against losing their right to filibuster. Now, in the end, they have basically accepted two or three extremely controversial people to be on the appeals court. And so in that sense, the Democrats have lost ground. But they have, as you were saying a moment ago, lived to fight another day. And what they're really interested in here is preserving the right to filibuster an unacceptable Supreme Court nominee.
And what was in this for the Republicans? Why were the Republican moderates that interested in preventing this going all the way to the confrontation that was promised?
I think some of the Republican moderates are looking at their reelection prospects in 2006 or 2008. But I think more than that, they do not like the characterization of their party being in thrall to a few activist groups on the right, particularly social conservatives, religious activists, the kinds of people who are denouncing this compromise today and saying that it was a sellout and a bailing out by their Republican allies. There is some pushback against that influence in the Republican Party, and I think you saw that in the seven senators who were willing to sign this agreement.
Now, we did hear a sort of sigh of relief from the Democratic leader in the Senate, Harry Reid. We did not hear the same response from Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Does that mean that he may have some discomfort with the idea of a compromise, that he was looking forward to the duel?
I don't know if he was looking forward to the duel itself, but I do think that what we see this morning in the Senate is a Senate being run by people other than Bill Frist. The Senate Majority Leader's job is to find the deal, to find the compromise, to bring the two parties together to get most of what the president wants or most of what the majority wants. That's what his job is. He did not do it. Somebody else had to step in. John McCain, with a big assist from John Warner, who wrote some of this language that finally turned the key, language that looked too difficult to find 24 hours ago. Lindsey Graham, other Republicans, stood up and made the deal when Bill Frist could not or would not. And it doesn't really matter whether he chose not to or whether he was incapable of it. The fact is, he was not able to lead the Senate and be the Senate Majority Leader. Somebody else had to do it. It's hard for me to see how he would be enthusiastic about that.
Ron, I want you to ask you if you can just sit tight for a couple of minutes while I bring in a couple of other guests. Dan Schnur is joining us on the line from Sacramento, California. He's a Republican political and media consultant and was director of communications for John McCain's presidential campaign. Dan, it's nice to have you back with us.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for having me.
And Elaine Kmark's joining us from a studio in Cambridge. She is a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and former senior policy advisor to former Vice President Al Gore. Elaine, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
I'm going to start, Dan Schnur, if I can, with you, just on the last thing that Ron was saying. Are we looking here at a shift in power in the Senate away from the sort of extremist leadership sides and more back towards a moderate middle?
I don't know if it's a shift in power back toward the middle, but it's the first time we've seen the center of either party significantly assert itself in the Senate in quite some time. So I don't know if this hails for a great new era of bipartisanship and centrism in the Senate. Probably far from it. But what it does do is reminds the moderates of both parties that if they do work together, they can achieve their goals. So I'd still look at this as an aberration rather than a trend, but it's probably a healthy aberration.
Something you're pleased with?
Oh, absolutely. I think my former boss, Senator McCain, did a, not that I'm unbiased on this, but did the Senate. A real service. Everyone keeps talking about the House of Representatives-ification of the Senate as it becomes more bitter and more partisan. And I think what was striking about this deal, and I'd be very interested in hearing what Ron and Elaine have to say about it, is that the compromise actually, I think in a lot of ways, was less about ideology, moderates versus liberals or conservatives, than it was about the tradition of the Senate. And what you saw was a lot of older members of the Senate, John Warner, Robert Byrd, and others, reminding their younger brethren that the Senate does play a fundamentally different role in the process than the House of Representatives does.
Elaine, let's hear from you on that, because while there were so many people speaking about the importance of maintaining the tradition and the rules, we were also hearing a lot from the Democrats about their determination not to allow some of these judges to go through, and now it seems they will.
Well, I think two things were happening here, and it's very interesting that Dan brought up the age of Byrd, who's 87, and Senator Warner, who's 78. And what I noted buried in today's paper was that the two of them spent the weekend reading Federalist 66, which is one of the Federalist papers dealing with the appointment process of judges and what exactly the advice and consent of the Senate seems to me. One of the things that happened here was that the traditionalists in the Senate decided that trying to preserve the consultation role of the Senate as opposed to the quick decision and partisan role of the House was frankly more important than some of the disputes over these judges. And so in some senses, I think this was a triumph of democracy. Let me also just say on Frist, I think that Senator Frist is clearly running for president, and it shows once again how difficult it is to run for the presidency from the position of leadership in the House or the Senate.
Okay, but Elaine, I began by saying that it looked like the Democrats were negotiating a little bit from a position of weakness here. Did they have to give up a point of principle to keep the filibuster?
I think they had to give up some of these judges, and I think some of these judges are really, really hard for Democrats to swallow. Pryor, particularly, who thinks the Voting Rights Act is obsolete. I mean, you know, some of these judges are very, very difficult. But I also think that the Democrats understand, as the Republicans do, that they've now survived to another day, and the other day is the Supreme Court nomination. And let's face it, that's where all of this is headed towards a Supreme Court nomination.
Now, Ron Elving, I want you to help me with your definition of two words that seem a little woolly to me. That is extraordinary circumstances. That's the language in the compromise, is that the filibuster can be sort of dragged out of the closet and plugged in and used for extraordinary circumstances. What does that mean?
I think it means a Supreme Court nominee who is anything other than a mainstream conservative. We don't expect a mainstream liberal to come out of this White House, of course. It's going to be some flavor of conservative.
So a John Ashcroft nomination would be extraordinary circumstances in the minds of the Democrats?
I think you could count on it. I think the odds are pretty good that anybody that Bush is really happy about nominating, and by the way, some of the people he might nominate might well be some of the people we've already talked about.
That's,
with respect to these appellate positions. Anybody he's likely to be happy about is going to strike at least some Democrats as extraordinary circumstances. A Clarence Thomas would certainly, I think, fit in that category today. Robert Bork from 1987 mm-hmm. would certainly have fit in those definitions. And so the question will become, how many of these seven Democrats who signed this agreement will be among those who think it's extraordinary circumstances when such a justice is nominated or such a person is nominated to be a justice? And that's really what's going to determine how good this agreement is. Otherwise, this agreement is just totally a postponement, a delaying tactic.
All right. We'll continue this conversation with our callers and with Dan Schnur and Elaine K. Mark. Ron Elving, a chance to say thanks to you for helping us get started this morning.
Thank you very much.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, the compromise in the Senate last night was this: politicians coming to their senses, realizing that people weren't really as caught up in the arcane matters of the Senate. Or, in fact, was this something that you were watching carefully and an important moment in American democracy? 1-800-423-TALK is the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Well, the Senate chose not to go over the edge of the cliff on its battle over filibusters and judicial nominees, which was something that was promised for today. There was a compromise struck last night, in case you are just tuning in, one which allows a number of those judicial nominees to go ahead, but one in which the Democrats are allowed to retain the use of the filibuster, for the words in the agreement, under extraordinary circumstances. We're going to hear one more reaction to what happened last night, this from Republican Senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham.
Here's what I know is going to happen now. People at home are going to be very upset at me for a while. Judges are going to get a vote that wouldn't have gotten a vote otherwise. We're going to start talking about who would be a good judge and who wouldn't. And the White House is going to get more involved, and they're going to listen to us more. Some of them are going to make it on our up-and-down vote, and some of them won't. And that's been the history of the Senate for 200 years. Bottom line, we can repair it in a way that will allow the country to have a Senate that functions for the common good.
Elaine K. Mark is with us. She is a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and Dan Schnur, political and media consultant for the Republican Party. What I hear, Dan, in the senator's comments there is an acknowledgement that there may be a larger shift in power happening here, where the White House, rather than having more say over the Senate, has less. Do you get that or not?
Well, as I said a few minutes ago, it's a positive sign that centrists of both parties can be reminded, as they were over the last few days, that they do have some authority in a body like the Senate. Whether it turns into a trend, I think it's a little bit too early to tell. I think it's worth remembering that this was a Frist-driven exercise. Elaine made the right point. Bill Frist is running for president. No secret about it. And running against people whose biographies lend themselves more to support from the religious conservative community, people like Senators Brownback and Santorum and some others, Frist needed an issue like this one to reassert himself in that wing of the party. So this was much more of a Frist drill than a White House drill. The White House certainly wanted to see it done, but as I think you guys have reported over the last few weeks, the White House really has kept at arm's length from this fight. I think if there's a lesson for the White House to have learned from this, it's when they want something from the Hill, they've got to roll up their sleeves get and walk down Pennsylvania Avenue and engage directly, that they can't rely on their surrogates to get it done for them.
Okay, but Elaine, certainly the president will have to take note of the fact that the moderates had that amount of power to wield on that evening and may be willing to use it again.
You bet. And I also think it's going to be fascinating to watch if we do get a Supreme Court vacancy during this Bush term, which is likely. It'll be fascinating to watch how the Bush White House handles these 14 senators, because these 14 senators may well decide that they need to get together and decide more than just this question. They may need to get together and be the final place where the White House comes to see if something's going to get through the Senate or not. It'd be interesting to see if they decided to use this new little caucus of theirs on Social Security reform. It'd be interesting to see if they decided to use this in vetting a future Supreme Court nominee. So it could be the beginning of something quite interesting, as Dan has suggested, or it could be simply sui generis and we'll go back to partisan wrangling tomorrow.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Mebane, North Carolina for our first call from Will. Will, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make 2 points. One is you made the assertion that most people don't care or not paying any attention. And I'm not really sure if that's true. And I know I've been paying really close attention to it. And I do care a lot about it. And I mentioned before, I'm a moderate Democrat, sorry, but I voted for, when I lived in Utah, I voted for Mike Leavitt, who's a Republican governor. But I would just say I'm really encouraged with the moderates who found a compromise, and B, so disgusted with the Republican leadership, especially Bill Frist. I just think the extremism and the lack of compromise and just the overall spin, I'm just sickened by it.
Well, when I made the point about people basically losing interest or saying a plague on both party houses here, I was trying to make sense of public opinion polls that are saying, a lot of people really aren't too plugged in. So in answer to, what do you say in answer to the question, what matters in Washington? Is it just that you're interested in politics as a game, or are these the issues? Are these the issues that you want these senators talking about?
Well, I mean, for one thing, I just think the judiciary is such an important branch. I mean, I think a lot of people are aware of that. It might not be in, like, a day-to-day following a sense, but, I think a lot of people are aware how important the upcoming, possible Supreme Court, nomination is going to be. And maybe again, even, like, a less focused sense, I think people are aware, like, how important the appellate courts are. And I think the nominations that are coming up are just so far from the mainstream. I mean, that's what I care about. I can't really speak for the entire.
No, I'm not asking you to speak. I thank you for your call. I want to hear from both Dan and Elaine on this question of how connected people are to the issue of who the federal court judges will be, because it seemed, Elaine, so far that this is not the kind of issue that catches people's attention, like simple stories, the price of gas, the war in Iraq, other issues like that.
Or Viagra for criminals, yeah. I do think, however, that people were looking at this, and one of the things you saw in the public opinion polls was, first of all, the Republican leadership was getting hurt more than the Democratic leadership was. And one public opinion poll asked the question in a really interesting way. They said, is the Senate acting more like a bunch of 10-year-olds or like adults? And overwhelmingly, the public said they're acting like 10-year-olds. And I think what was happening was that even though people may not follow particularly who these judges are and what they stand for, they do expect from the United States Senate, there is this long tradition of a sort of gentlemanly and ladylike behavior towards each other. And to see the Senate dissolve into this kind of hostility, I think was reflecting very badly on the leadership of the Senate. And since the Republicans have the majority, it was reflecting particularly badly on the Republican leadership. And I think that that is the way the public was processing this entire thing, even if they weren't necessarily informed about who the judges were.
Dan?
I guess I'd make 2 points very quickly, Dick. Number one, I think the caller was right to some degree that there are people, of course, who care about this, but they tend to be disproportionately the most loyal bases of the two major parties.
Right.
The most liberal Democrats and the most conservative Republicans care a lot about judicial appointments. And I think one of the things we saw with Frist and with the Democratic leadership as well is them being pulled not by the mainstream of public opinion, but by their most vociferous supporters. The second point I'd make relates to what issues people care about. And I think you make the right point on that one, Dick, because for most voters, this is somewhat of an abstract. I think along those lines, the Democrats really dodged a bullet on this compromise, because had they followed through with Byrd's threat to shut down the Senate, just as Republicans suffered in the mid-1990s at the hands of Elaine's former boss, Bill Clinton, when they shut down the government, I think the spectacle of Senate Democrats shutting down Congress and keeping Congress from acting on issues like gasoline prices, on issues like taxes, on issues like education, on issues like environmental protection, would have voted very poorly for them from a partisan basis. This gets them off the hook of having to follow through on that threat.
Let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina, for a call from Barry. Barry, thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Dick. Great show as usual. Just wanted to say that I feel that I grew up in a staunchly Democratic home, and I've become a small business owner as an adult and lean a little bit more Republican now. But what I saw happening just really ticked me off. I mean, I think that there are so many important issues, not that this isn't, but in historical sense, this should have been taken care of a long time ago and not come to this and wasted as much of our time in the U.S. Senate when there are so many more important things, and you alluded to them earlier, the war, economics, just so many things that they should be addressing, and this is not one that we should spend this kind of time with.
Do you think, Barry, that the decision on the part of the moderate senators to go for a compromise was an acknowledgement from at least those people and perhaps a majority of the people there that what they were arguing about wasn't the sort of thing which was, you know, consuming the talk of the coffee shops in Greensboro?
Well, I think what happened was that polls showed them that, and that's when they made this flip on it. But I think the big loser is the entire Senate, and the winner is John McCain.
Why so?
Well, I think it really reflected poorly on the Senate. So I think that overall, the impression that I've gotten from people I've talked with is that the Senate is kind of in the doghouse. But McCain, you know, he's the one getting all the PR on the shows right now and coming out as a hero at the last tick of the clock to avert this whole thing.
Now, my natural segue from that is to Dan Schneur, who used to work for Senator McCain. But I'm going to resist that and go to Elaine and say, Elaine, so the Republicans get all the credit for this.
Listen, I think John McCain does deserve a lot of credit, as does Joe Lieberman. But really, the heroes of this are these two old guys, Senator Byrd and Senator Warner, who are not running for president and who literally had the liberty or the freedom, so to speak, to step back and try to figure out what was the best thing for the Senate and the best thing for the country. The other thing I would say about this is I think this poses a real problem for Senator Frist, and you alluded to it earlier. What happens to a Senate majority leader who cannot lead the Senate? What happens if this group of 14 now makes it a practice to make decisions and take decision-making out of the hands of Senator Frist? I think that even though he's trying his darndest to play to the extreme right that controls Republican primaries, I think, frankly, this image of a weak leader will, in fact, end up hurting his presidential aspirations and not helping them.
But, Elaine, surely the idea that seven moderate Republicans are going to step in front of a speeding train two or three times a week in opposition to their own leader is not really very likely.
But I don't think two or three times a week. I don't think you need to do it two or three times a week to hurt Frist. I think you need to do it two or three times a year, and he will be hurt.
Dan.
Dick, I think Bill Frist is hurt by this, but for different reasons than I think Elaine is citing. First of all, Bill Frist is not going to get the Republican nomination for president because he was an effective Senate leader. If he gets the nomination, it will be because he convinced the conservative base of the party that he has their interests at heart. He could run a very harmonious Senate. He could have overseen this deal with his gang of 14, and it would have killed him among conservatives. just as there are a lot of liberals who are going to be very suspicious of Harry Byrd.
So what are you saying, that 6 months or a year or 2 years from now, 06 or 08, whatever we're talking about, he's going to be able to refer back to this, which we'll all barely remember at that point, and say, I didn't cave. I held my ground?
No, I don't think that. I think, like I said, I think he will suffer for this, but he won't suffer because he wasn't a good shepherd of the Senate. He will suffer because he was not able to end the filibuster as promised.
Right, okay, I've got...
So conservative activists, just like liberal activists in Elaine's party, have very, very long memories, and they're not going to forgive him for this. But it's an entirely different lack of forgiveness than the kind Elaine's talking about.
Well, that's interesting, and I think Dan makes a good point on that, yes.
Either way, he's unforgiven.
Yeah. All right.
Either way, he's in trouble.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us this hour to Northborough, Massachusetts, for a call from Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning.
So what do you think?
You can't dress this compromise up for anything other than what it is. This is a major defeat, a major disgrace for the Democrats. There's no point in preserving a filibuster if you then can't proceed to use it. One of the points that was brought up, quote, we need a compromise, we need a compromise. This was a president that came up with, around 200 nominations for the judiciary. He got every one of them except seven. And the Democrats can't even stand up to him against that. This is a party that's spineless. This is a party that's lost.
I'm going to get you to make this case to Elaine here.
Go ahead, Elaine.
Hi, how are you?
Good. By the way, I think you ought to know that right after this call, at the end of this hour, I'm going down to the town hall, and I'm changing from Democrat to independent. That's how furious I am.
Well, let me just try and keep you from making that trip. I mean, I think that part of the problem the Democrats were facing was that if, in fact, this had gone to a vote, the Republicans were very, very close to having the votes to make the change to getting rid of the filibuster forever. I think, in fact, this was a very smart deal for the Democrats to cut, because what this does is it preserves the right to use the filibuster, and particularly for the big fight coming down the road, which is the Supreme Court nominee. And so I think that the Democrats really didn't have a lot of options. The Republicans have 55 votes. They have a majority. And what they were about to do was they were about to use a simple majority, just 50 plus one, including Dick Cheney, 50 plus one. They were going to use that majority to fundamentally alter the Senate. And what that would have done is prevented Democrats from stopping any future action, such as a Social Security bill they didn't like, a Supreme Court nominee they didn't like. So I think, in fact, that the Democrats made the proper call, given the political reality, which is they don't have a majority of votes in the Senate.
Elaine, what's to prevent them, that is to say the Republicans, from using the so-called nuclear option when the Supreme Court nominees come up? And when these other issues come up, what's to prevent them from doing it then? You can say that the filibuster has been preserved until when? Till the Republicans call the Democratic bluff again?
Yeah, but I think what will happen at that point is that if it's a Supreme Court nominee, the stakes will be high enough that then the Democrats will be able to use the second weapon, which they were threatening to use after the filibuster, which is to really stop the Senate's business. And the country will understand that this is worth the fight because it is a Supreme Court nominee.
And you're also saying, Elaine, though, that if the Republicans were to use the so-called nuclear option at that point, that enough people would be watching and there'd be enough public criticism that would restrain them from that?
Well, I think that they might still use the nuclear option, but at this point, if it's a Supreme Court nominee, this becomes a nationwide fight. If the Democrats then had to respond to that nuclear option by stopping the business of the Senate, which is what they were threatening to do had it been used this time, then I think the stakes would be high enough that the Democrats would stand a chance of getting the country behind them.
What do you think,
I think,
Bill?
That was not the case in this instance.
I think that the Democrats have got an awful lot of practice in rolling over and playing dead, and this is another example of it. They always find an excuse to put off the fight for another day. This is a time
that they are in the minority in the House and in the Senate, and they don't hold the White House bill. I mean, it's difficult for them, no?
I understand that. But having said that, you're looking at a public at large that says, wait a minute, this is a party that won't fight for anything, even if they are facing defeat.
All right, Bill, thanks for that call. Connection listeners, do you agree with that point, that this is a place where the Democrats could have, should have, taken a stand? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. If we are to balance out the decision last night, is there a winner? Is there a loser? Your thoughts on that? Or are you even paying attention to all this? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. And people who were expecting the battle royale in the Senate are breathing a little bit easier today. There was a compromise worked out last night, so the fight over the future of the filibuster and judicial nominations has been, well, delayed for a time, if you want to look at it that way. Or perhaps the moderates have made their voice known in a way that will change the partisan nature of this Senate. We'd like to know if you're paying close attention to what's going on in that House, or if you have sort of given up on all the partisanship and the politics in Washington. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Elaine Kmark is with us. She is a former senior policy advisor to Al Gore and currently a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School. Dan Schnur was head of communications for John McCain's presidential campaign, and he is a political and media consultant for the Republican Party. We're going to Aberdeen, North Carolina for a call from Ellen. Ellen, thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, I'm offended when people say that I'm a stay-at-home mom with two young girls, so yes, I'm extremely concerned, and I've been following this. And I think that you have President Bush, who is so removed from the moderate Republicans and the moderate Democrats, that he is appointing extreme judges that are scary. And he's not thinking of his Senate, the Republicans either, when he does this. And he put his Senate between a rock and a hard place.
But didn't he get his wrist slapped by this compromise last night, at least in a small way, Ellen?
I don't think so, because I think that he's going to continue to push because he's so blindsided. He's like Marie Antoinette, who said, let him eat cake. You know, she was looking at what she had, and he's looking at what he has and what he wants and hopes to accomplish while he sends his wife over to, you know, try to do something for women's rights. He stands here and does everything he can to oppose women's rights by his appointment.
All right, so you're saying that he is intricately involved in the backroom politics here rather than taking a hands-off approach and letting the Senate handle it?
Oh, he has got his hand in the fire. He is wanting this to happen.
I'm going to have Dan Schnur talk to you on this one. Dan.
I think the last two callers have both made a point that we were talking about earlier on how difficult it is for centrists of either party to come to compromise without feeling pressure from their party's most extreme wings. Just as conservative Republicans are not going to be happy with Bill Frist's inability to bring an end to the filibuster, the last two callers represent a growing and vital wing of the Democratic Party that doesn't like compromise, and they want to see their people fight George Bush even if they lose. Now, from my standpoint as a Republican, we call that the Howard Dean strategy, and we think it's just fine. But for Elaine,
well, you said you think it's just fine, Dan, as long as you can put it in a place where the numbers aren't threatening, right? As long as you can convince yourself it's 15 or 20 or 30% of the opposition, rather than something that's growing, right?
Well, if it's growing, then that's fine. Also, my point is, and I think the Democrats saw this during their primary process last year, is that allowing the most extreme voices of a party to define that party is a bad idea for either party. So when you have centrists, again, Republicans and Democrats, standing up to that pressure in a way that the leaders of the two parties can't, I think it shows how difficult it is in this era of politics when the extremes of both parties have so much voice and so much weight. I guess I'd make one other point.
Dan, just before you do, are you saying that Ellen, in the views that she's expressed, represents that extreme version of the Democratic perspective here?
I think the last two callers do. And I think a caller, and I respect her opinion, although I happen to disagree with it, I think a caller who compares the President of the United States to Marie Antoinette is not and I think Elaine would agree with me on this, is not articulating the voice that the Democratic Party ought to be articulating if it's looking to regain its majority status.
Go ahead.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, you can.
Bush has his war, and he can have his million-dollar inaugural ball and shake his butt for the camera while our men are over there dying for I'm not sure what. And if that is not someone completely removed and has his own agenda, I don't know what is.
Well, and I think Ellen makes my point. Again, while I disagree with her, I respect her opinions. But those are opinions that are well to the left of the American mainstream. And I'd like to hear Elaine on this, because I think she would agree that a Democratic Party that articulates an agenda along the lines of the last caller is not one that's going to return to the majority anytime soon.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with the last caller, Dan. I mean, look, the president brought us into a war on false pretenses. Let's face it, didn't pan out. He was wrong about why he brought us into that war. Now, and there are men and women dying over there, and you have to ask, where are the weapons of mass destruction? I mean, I think she makes a point that is in fact shared by over 50% of the American population, and in fact, I think Ellen's point of view, which I do not think is to the far left of the Democratic Party at all. I think her point of view is in fact gaining in the United States, because you look at the president's approval ratings today, they're down to nearly his lowest point ever. They're at 46%.
Let's take one example that she raised, and I think we can use this as a good example of mainstream. She talked about how the president's judicial selections are bad for women. Now, I assume in the case of Priscilla Owen, the case that she's talking about, the case on parental consent, the idea that was argued in the Texas case, and which actually I see in the paper this morning is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, that suggests that a teenage girl is pregnant, needs to have her parents notified before she seeks an abortion. Now, there are 33 states in this country that have a law along those lines. There are 8 others that have passed laws along those lines that are currently being debated in court. Over 60% of the American public, pro-choice and pro-life Americans alike, think that asking a teenager who needs her parents' permission to go to a tanning salon ought to seek her parents' permission for a procedure like this one, except in extraordinary cases in which there's, you know, counsel and judicial options available. Priscilla Owens being vilified because she voices an opinion that I would argue is very much in the mainstream of American public opinion. You may not happen to agree with it, Elaine. The caller may not happen to agree with it. But I think calling someone extreme because she takes a position like that is talking to the base of the Democratic Party, not reaching to the center. And I think it speaks to the problem the Democrats are going to have reclaiming a majority.
But I don't think that the Democrats are going to have a problem reclaiming a majority, because I think what the caller's referring to, and we probably ought to let the caller speak, but this president has in fact pulled the nation far to the right. And what you see in the last 12 months between the Terry Schiavo case and the Social Security initiative is a lot of people are getting very uncomfortable with this president. They are not willing to grant him the trust that they gave him in his first term, and which some people think he abused.
Let us go back to the Senate, and let us go back to the compromise and to the callers who want to be in on that. We're going to Tulsa, Oklahoma for a call from Chip. Hi, Chip.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call.
Yeah.
I listen to your show every morning. I guess what I'm really frustrated about is the simple fact that there's so many more important things going on in the world, and to literally grind everything to a halt over whether or not to preserve a filibuster just seems absurd. When you look at the bigger picture, I mean, the country as a whole has got far more important things to look at instead of, you know, judiciary. I mean, they were put up once. They were shot down. He's put them up again. The first time should have been more than enough. I mean, you get one swing at the plate. If you strike out, next one up. I mean, there's no point in going back and just continuing to tread over the same ground repeatedly just because I want.
Okay, but we might have been talking on this program, Chip, about the two sides facing off, each holding a bat. And instead, we're talking about a compromise where each side kind of holds its nose a little bit. The Republicans have to grant the Democrats the continued use of the filibuster, something that they didn't want to do. And the Democrats have to allow a couple of these controversial or conservative judicial nominees to go to an up or down vote on the Senate. Is the compromise itself, the stuff of that, in any way encouraging when you are tearing your hair out over the lack of bipartisanship?
Well, I think what I'm tearing my hair out over is the fact that, in the first 4 years, if I'm not mistaken, he put, the 10 key points of contention, the 10 judiciary nominees up, and they were denied, turned down. And now he's got this, I want what I want when I want it thing going on. He did it with the war and the Social Security and everything else. And so now they're back again. And so now we've ground down to a stalemate. I mean, compromise.
Can I ask you just one more question, though, Chip? Sure. If he put those names up and he had them turned down in the first term, and then the man is reelected, does he have the right to say, hey, a new mandate, a new opportunity to put those people up?
No.
Why?
Well, I mean, he had an opportunity. I mean, there's no point in continuing to try to push the same stuff through. That's where we get the gridlock. That's where we have the problems. That's how.
So here's where I'm confused. You're frustrated by the lack of bipartisanship, but you wanted the Democrats to go to the mat over this one, right?
I would have liked to have seen them go to the mat and to force somebody's hand. But at the same time, I don't even see why we even had to get into the ring.
Yeah.
I guess just over the last several years, I've become more politically aware as I'm getting a little bit older and I've got kids and I'm working, and it just seems really crazy the amount of time that the legislature as a whole, I mean the entire federal program, just seems to just get mired and ground down into all of this just stuff that just seems like it's a waste of time and money and resources when there's I'm having to supplement my wife's classroom with VCRs and material so that she can teach. I don't know whether my mom is going to have health care as she gets older. I don't know if I'm going to have Social Security when I get older. I'm paying insane amounts of insurance.
My impression, though, Chip, let me turn back to my guests here, is that those last questions that you were raising were, in fact, questions in the backs of the minds of the senators. Elaine, I have to think that Democrats and Republicans were looking at their rhetoric in the next day's newspaper and going, oh, maybe this isn't what people want from us.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the caller is expressing what probably a lot of people felt, which is for the Senate to get on with the work of the Senate and stop in this sort of poll reaction that they were acting like 10-year-olds as opposed to acting like adults. They expect the Senate to deliberate and to come up with what's best for the country. But let me just say to the caller that one of the things that I think was important about the filibuster is that the effect of this kind of funny rule is that, in fact, on really big issues and really important things, the effect of that rule is to make sure that, in fact, a large majority of the Senate is in favor of something. And I think that's actually important to American democracy because that preserves the right of the minority to have a say in the decision making. And so even though the Republicans are in charge of the Senate and they have the most votes on really big issues, whether it's Social Security or whether it's a Supreme Court nominee, because the filibuster exists, they will have to take into account the views of at least some of the Democrats in the Senate. And I think that helps make our policies better.
Let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia, for a call from Curtis. Curtis, I think you may agree with this.
Yeah, what was at stake in this fight was the nature of the Senate as an institution. The Senate was never intended to be an institution that was ruled by a 51% majority. That's what the House is about. The House is the House of the people. The Senate represents states and the interests of states. And it's the saucer in which the hot tea cools, so to speak. I worked there for many years. And when I worked there, and I worked mostly for Republicans, though I did work for a Democrat for a couple of years, and when we went to a meeting, if the Republicans organized the meeting, Democrats went along to the meeting and vice versa, because that's the way the institution works.
So can I ask your opinion based on your experience in that institution, if you think that it has become less effective because it's become more partisan in recent years.
Well, it has become less effective, but that's been the intended consequence. One caller said, oh, I don't know about Social Security or whatever, but what they have here is they've had a very effective tool for preventing, and when I say they, I'm really talking about Republicans, for preventing legislation from happening. And what they were doing here was they were converting a body that was not intended to be a majority body into one in which you can rule with a simple 51 votes. So with a simple 51 votes...
Right, but it didn't happen, Curtis. It didn't happen. That's what the compromise is about, no?
No. This isn't over yet, and your woman guest may be right that with the Supreme Court nominee, the American people may come to realize what's going on. But no, they came. The fact of the matter is, this compromise would never have occurred if the Republicans hadn't had the votes.
Okay, let's go to Dan Schnur on that. Having been that close to the kind of battle that we were looking at, Dan, is it your expectation that something else, whether or not it's an approval of a John Bolton or a Supreme Court nomination or even a particularly contentious piece of legislation on something like stem cell, that we're going to be here and talking about that kind of confrontation and the death of the filibuster and so on at some point soon?
We are going to be back there again, and I think Senator McCain made the right point on this very early in the efforts for a compromise. He said, look, the world turns. The party that's in the majority today is going to be in the minority at some point in the future, at which point they're going to desperately want the filibuster. If you look back to the 1990s when there was a Democratic president appointing justices who weren't being confirmed, you had leading Democrats, Senator Schumer, Senator Boxer, Senator Leahy, Senator Kennedy, all talking about how the filibuster was impeding the will of the people. Ted Kennedy's on record from 1998 saying, we owe it to Americans across the country to give these nominees a vote. If our Republican colleagues don't like them, vote against them, but give them a vote. Schumer and Leahy and Boxer are on the record, as are several others, saying the same thing. All of which is a long way of saying, Dick, that number one, we will be back here when there's a Supreme Court nominee. So Republicans pocketed three judges this week, and we'll go back to the same fight in a couple months after Rehnquist retires. But second, as long as there is a majority party in the United States Senate, either party, there will be efforts to end the filibuster. And as long as there's a minority party, there will be a fight to keep it from being taken away.
And Elaine, do you think that it will always be maintained, that people will always want to step back from that ultimate decision?
Well, I think that the tradition of the Senate, as our caller pointed out, is the Senate is the place where the hot tea cools, and I love that analogy. I think that that tradition is so precious to a lot of people who've studied American history that as long as you have a Senator Warner and a Senator Byrd and you have some people in the Senate with an eye towards the preservation of the institution, I think you're going to have people who will, in fact, preserve the filibuster.
I want to thank both of you for being with me on the program. Again, Elaine, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Elaine Kmark, lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. And Dan Schnur, nice to have you as well.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Dan is Republican political and media consultant. Earlier in the program, we talked briefly with Ron Elving, who is senior Washington editor for NPR News. Our program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.